Thousands show up in Key West for a party, but Fantasy Fest was canceled. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. City officials in Key West long ago canceled the week-long party that attracts tens of thousands of visitors, but lots of people are showing up anyway. What does this mean for enforcement and the possibility of a surge of cases? Also,
the 2000 election was a street brawl for the presidency of the United States.
20 years ago, Miami sent the nation into a whirlwind of uncertainty. Filmmaker Billy Corbin is back with a documentary, 537 Votes, a look at the 2000 election. Finally, what would you see if you walked the distance of Florida? Author Kent Russell tells the story of his trek from the panhandle to Miami and our book club pick in the land of good living. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. You know, normally this time in October, tens of thousands of people would be making their way to Key West for Fantasy Fest. But the event and all the parties that happened around that time were canceled because of COVID. Well, a lot of people are making their way to Key West anyway. Officials are worried that with a growing coronavirus rate, this could lead to a new surge. Joining us now is WLRN's Monroe County reporter, Nan Klinginer, joining us via Skype. Nan, always great to have you.
Thanks, Luis.
So remind us, I mean, this is the week. This is Fantasy Fest. This is the big party. This is what happens this time of year?
Usually, the town absolutely fills up. And usually, certainly by this time in the week, you're starting to see people walk around, even during the day, wearing costumes or maybe even topless and body painted.
And how many people usually come for Fantasy Fest?
You know, I've heard all kinds of different estimates, but up to like 60,000 people being here for the big Saturday night parade. Some of those are day trippers, and there are buses that come down just for that night. But tens of thousands, it is certainly safe to say.
So I don't know. Did you say this on Twitter? Like it's like canceling a party, but people show up anyway. People are still coming down to Key West anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly been the concern. And I was kind of riffing on that, you know, that feeling whenever you throw a party and then you're like, nobody's going to come. Nobody's going to come. So this is sort of the opposite of that.
All right. So what do you hear? What do you see already? You know,
I just rode my bike down Duval Street on my way into the studio. And there are definitely people. I didn't see anybody in costume. I certainly didn't see anybody topless. The hotels are running at about 50% occupancy this week, I'm hearing. And it's possible, I think it's very probable, in fact, that the lousy weather is keeping people away because it's just been raining constantly down here.
Okay, so if there's no party, if there's none of the events that were scheduled are going to happen, what are people expecting? Are they just going to have impromptu parties or what?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly been the expectation. Part of that fueled by this Facebook group out of Tampa that put up a slate of events on their group page. And they were sort of modeled on the usual Fantasy Fest events, like a zombie bike ride on Sunday. Now, what we saw on the Sunday when the weather was kind of lousy, to be sure, but was a couple dozen people were riding their bikes around, sort of dressed up like zombies, although the locals were not impressed with the costuming, I have to say.
And what are the locals saying about this?
Well, it sort of depends if you're in the tourism business and you're desperate for income or if you're worried about, increased COVID spread. So,
yeah, I'd imagine some of the businesses are happy, but I mean, have you talked to anybody about the risk they're taking?
Yeah, well, they're already taking those risks, to be honest with you. We've been really busy on weekends for the last couple months. I think there's just a lot of Floridians in particular who just really want to go somewhere, and this is a place you can drive to. And, especially since late September when the governor took the limits off the bars and restaurants and removed sanctions about masks, it's been busy.
All right. So what are city leaders, what's law enforcement saying, about this surge of people coming in, even though there's no Fantasy Fest, but they want to have a party anyway? What are they going to do?
Yeah. Their official word is, usually they set up this thing they call the Fantasy Zone in downtown, like on Duval Street. And there you can drink from an open container of alcohol on the street, which isn't usually allowed. And you can even be topless as long as you're body painted within that Fantasy Zone. And this year they're like, there is no Fantasy Zone. All the rules apply. There are no events.
But are law enforcement ready to enforce? Are they ready to, you can hand out citations. You're not collecting on it. Not right now anyway. But I mean, what can they do? What do they want to do?
Yeah. I mean, they can do what you would normally do, trespass people if the business owner wanted them trespassed from an establishment. They can arrest people for drunk and disorderly. They could arrest people for public nudity. I know they have extra officers on standby. And like all of us, they're just kind of waiting to see what happens.
Yeah, we're all just waiting to see what happens with this. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm talking with WLRN's Monroe County reporter, Nan Klinger. Again, Fantasy Fest was canceled for this week because of the pandemic, but there are people going down to Key West anyway. And you could read more of her reporting on this on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Nan, the COVID numbers from Monroe County going up. Positivity rates going up, right?
Yeah. I was just checking, and today's positivity rate is 14%, which is really scary. Our 14-day average is 7.5%. Our 7-day average is 9%. So those numbers are going up, and they've basically been going up all month.
The Key West City Council decided they actually had to return to virtual meetings. They did open up again, but now they're back to virtual meetings. We heard from Bob Eady, administrator of the Florida Department of Health in Monroe County. He talked about the concern of seeing these numbers go up with events that are still happening this week. Here's what he said.
You talk about events where people don't wear masks. I mean, it's like people don't wear anything. So I doubt they'll be wearing a mask, although I don't have problems with that. If they wear a mask, I don't care whatever else they have or don't have on. But it is a time when you have people celebrating, to be close together, and in this case, they'll be indoors. So all the ingredients for transmitting the disease are there. So yes, I'm concerned.
What else did he say? What else is his concern? And I also wonder about ICU capacity. What's going on there?
Yeah, our hospitalizations have also been going up. We were down to maybe like 2 or 3 a day for a while there in September. And as of yesterday, it was 7, all at Lower Keys Medical Center. They only have 7 ICU beds at Lower Keys Medical Center. Obviously, not all these people are necessarily in the ICU. And at the check-in call for emergency management yesterday, the Lower Keys hospital administrator said they were good on staffing, on capacity, and on supplies.
And just to remind people, like, what, there's the Lower Keys Medical Center, that's like the only hospital, right, within 50 miles of Key West?
Right, and Fisherman's in Marathon, which is the next closest, is just a temporary facility because the building was destroyed in Hurricane Irma, so they only have 4 beds there.
Yeah, I'm curious because I remember back to the beginning of the pandemic, and Monroe County basically just closed the road and said, you're not coming in,
right,
because they wanted to protect the population, because Miami-Dade has always been still the top when it comes to highest in COVID rates and so forth. But what's happening now? It seems like, have attitudes shifted and people have just accepted that? Or is there a call to say, wait, rates are going up again, maybe let's rethink this?
Yeah, I mean, there's no one talking about putting the checkpoint up, although I'm sure some people would like that. But none of the public officials are advocating for that at this point, for sure. And I don't know that they would get support from the state. I mean, everything you see from the governor is, saying lockdown was a mistake. So we're just trying to, be safe and be careful.
Yeah, I mean, what other actions are there, or what are people like Bob Eadie saying about how could we bring these numbers down?
Well, it's the same thing that you hear from the CDC and everybody else. You know, wear a mask in public for sure. Avoid large gatherings, and wash your hands a lot, and get a flu shot.
Yeah. You know what? I have to, before I let you go, I wanted to ask, what have you seen when it comes to, because early voting started this week, and is that, that's also the case in Monroe County, right?
Absolutely. Yep. And early voting started yesterday.
What are you seeing so far? What are you hearing?
It was already much higher than the first day of early voting in 2016, and between early voting and the vote by mail ballots that have been returned, we're basically already at 30% turnout.
Everybody being safe, at least? Is there still like social distancing and masks while people wait in line?
Yes, absolutely. And there are drop boxes too at all the early voting locations. So if you have a vote by mail ballot but don't want to rely on the mail system, you can just drop it off right there and not even have to, you know, get near anybody.
All right. Well, Nan, I know you're down there in the center of it all as everybody wants to just make their way to Key West for a party that's not supposed to happen. But, you know, stay safe and let us know.
All right. Thanks, Lewis.
All right. Again, WLRN's Monroe County reporter Nan Klinginer. And yes, if you're heading down to Key West, there is no Fantasy Fest, even though people are still going. Try to be safe. Just try as much as you want to have fun. Well, still to come. 20 years ago, a debacle in South Florida led to the outcome of the presidential election. Could it happen again? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. 20 years ago this November, the national spotlight beamed heavily on Miami-Dade County, and not for a good reason. It was the closest presidential election in modern history, and the 537 votes separating George W. Bush and Al Gore were the focus of a recount.
He had this iconic moment, did Tim Russert on NBC, when he said, "It all comes down to Florida, Florida, Florida." He might as well have said, "It all comes down to Miami, Miami, Miami."
All right, so what you heard there was a cut from Rick Sanchez, a former television journalist in Miami. He's one of the featured voices in the new documentary, 537 Votes, from filmmaker Billy Corbin. Now, that airs tonight on HBO at 9 p.m. and will be available for streaming on HBO Max. We spoke with Billy last week and started by asking where he was during the fall of 2000.
We were working on our very first documentary, Raw Deal, A Question of Consent. We were on location in Gainesville in the spring, actually watching on TV as the Elian Gonzalez saga played out. And of course, the raid occurred on Easter Eve. And we're actually thinking, wow, this is really exciting. Maybe we should be making a documentary back home in Miami. But we were on the road in Gainesville. And later, by the fall, we were preparing for what we hoped would be the Sundance premiere.
Could you grasp at the time everything that was going on in Miami? Did you know that the epicenter of this whole thing that would change the world, not just the country, was Miami? It was going to be Miami.
I think already by that age, we were acutely aware of when we were living history. And this was certainly one of those moments. And by that age as well, we had already realized, thanks to T.D. Ullman's book, Miami City of the Future, that, you know, the Miami of today is the America of tomorrow, that really that we are, as T.D. said, the canary in the coal mine. And if you want to know what challenges we'll face or calamities will befall us as a nation in the years or even decades to come, you need only look at what's going on in South Florida.
Now, you look at in this movie a number of incidents that occur and how they all tie in together to lead to the debacle that was that election. Let's start with the first one, Elian Gonzalez.
It's almost impossible to tell that story, even in act one of our documentary when we tell it. And that's the thing about 537 votes, is that it is really a year in the life of Miami-Dade County. It begins on November 15th, 1999, when People magazine declared our county mayor, Alex Pinellas, America's sexiest politician. And then 10 days later, on Thanksgiving, this 5-year-old boy is found floating in an inner tube offshore by two fishermen and rescued. And it turns out that his mother and many others aboard a rickety makeshift raft had fled Cuba and had sunk and perished in the sea. And Elian Gonzalez and only a couple other people who were on the raft managed to survive days adrift in that inner tube. And it basically just, I mean, the Cuban exile community in Miami just galvanized around this child. And it turned into this international custody debacle where Elian's biological father, who by some accounts didn't even know his ex-wife was going to undertake this treacherous journey with their five-year-old son. He wanted his boy back. And Janet Reno, who had formerly for 15 years been the state attorney in Miami-Dade County, was now the attorney general. And she was about to try to negotiate the peaceful surrender, if you will, of this young boy to return him to his closest living relative who was willing and able to take him back. And by all accounts in custody law and immigration law, that was the appropriate course of action. But the Cuban American community down here did not want to hear it.
Look, we all remember it, that in the night, the government comes in, smashes in, takes this child, and the blame was on Clinton. They blamed Cuban Americans blamed Clinton and Janet Reno. But really, they still did blame Al Gore. They said, because of this, we're not going to give you the vote, right?
They didn't care whether it was Al Gore's fault or not. This was a proxy war. You know, they had lost Elian Gonzalez effectively. They had lost that battle, but they weren't about to win the war. And they declared voto castigo, the revenge vote, on Al Gore. And they were going to hold him responsible, again, as a proxy war. Like the one they were fighting with Fidel Castro over Elian Gonzalez, to say we're going to punish the Democrats in general, Bill Clinton, Janet Reno, and through the presidential election.
So we remember that election night. It was actually sadly humorous. Anchors calling at one point, Florida goes to Gore, then it's undecided, then it goes to Bush. But no, we're not decided. It goes into the middle of the night. And it was just, I mean, it was really this unbelievable back and forth, back and forth. But you know what? I mean, thinking about that, where did the problem really arise? Was it Miami-Dade? Was it Palm Beach County? Was it Broward County? They've been at the center of so many problems over so many years.
As Fernanda Mondi says in the documentary, the election was lost in many places, but it was stolen in Miami. Al Gore lost Tennessee. He lost his home state. There was the famous butterfly ballot that you alluded to in Palm Beach County, where 19,000 ballots were tossed out due to a double punch for Al Gore, likely for Al Gore and for Pat Buchanan, which resulted in the famous book Jews for Buchanan. So, which is a very unlikely voting block for Pat Buchanan, for those familiar with his politics. Certainly the purging, once again, we're seeing this tactic of disenfranchisement once again this year, the purging of felons from the voter rolls, which disproportionately impacted African-American voters, which who tend to vote more Democratic. So you had innocent people who were inadvertently and accidentally purged from the voter rolls, but were not able to vote in that election as a result. A lot of, again, similar tactics that you're seeing in this election today.
And, you know, going back to that election and the weeks after the election day, I mean, there were court battles and there was, you know, all this fighting about hand counts and hanging chads and pregnant chads. And again, you spoke to a lot of people. What was really interesting is how the two parties pretty much approached their strategy at that point. You spoke with Roger Stone. Let's hear a little bit of what he said.
I said, you know, everything here seems to be under control. He said, good, I want you to go down to Miami-Dade. Things down there are really screwed up.
There was going to be shenanigans and mischief. It was likely to be in Miami-Dade, so it made sense to go where it's likely to be stolen.
What were the Republicans' operatives doing, you know, behind the scenes?
There was a decision made pretty early on by both campaigns that Miami-Dade County was going to be the really the front line in the war for the presidency, which Roger Stone refers to as a street brawl for the presidency of the United States, the 2000 Florida recount. And they decided that that line was going to be drawn right here in Miami-Dade. It was one of the biggest and bluest counties. It was the most likely place that Al Gore could make up the 537 vote deficit that he had. That was the lead that George W. Bush had at the time. And in fact, it turned out to be true, because by the time they were done with partial recounts in Miami-Dade County and Palm Beach, Bush's lead had been reduced to 154 votes at that point. So this was working. This recount was discovering more votes for Al Gore. And the Republicans decided, first thing we're going to do is declare victory, because we're in the lead right now. So let's declare victory. George W. Bush is going to start putting together a cabinet and behave as though we're governing. And then everything that the Democrats do looks like they're on the defensive and they're trying to steal the victory away. They started labeling it, a revolution, like Fidel Castro is, you know, the Democrats are trying to come in and it's a coup is what it is. And that was really how they generated some enthusiasm and mobilized protesters to government center. But more importantly, they were not going to leave anything to chance. The Republicans decided that they were going to effectively stage a rather violent protest right in the canvassing board office in a government center in downtown Miami.
I'm speaking with filmmaker Billy Corbin with Raconteur Films. He directed the new HBO documentary, 537 Votes. It'll play on HBO Wednesday night at 9 p.m. and be available for streaming on HBO Max. You can find more details about the film on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Another person we heard from was Rick Sanchez, the television news anchor, and he said stuff that we're hearing again today, which is almost like calling an election fraud before the count is even done. Let's take a listen.
The talk in Miami at the time was that somehow the Gore faction were going to steal the election.
If I'm about to steal an election, the first thing I'm going to do is say they are going to steal.
And it's strange. We're hearing this now.
One of the chants during the so-called Brooks Brothers riot, this violent act demonstration that effectively ended the recount in Miami-Dade County, which was the beginning of the end of the 2000 election. They were chanting voter fraud. They were essentially calling the counting of legitimate ballots in an election fraud. We used to call that democracy, but the Republicans were calling it fraud. And it's the same thing that's happening now. Remember, you cannot escape the fact that Al Gore's position and the Democrats' position was, let's count all the votes, let the chips fall where they may, let's ensure that this is a legitimate election result, that we know who won, we know who the president is, and America will line up behind that person regardless of party affiliation. And the position of the Republicans was, we need to stop counting the votes now so long as George W. Bush has a microscopic lead.
Billy, do you think that this could happen again today? We're supposedly upgraded the technology in Broward, Palm Beach County, Miami-Dade. We've got early voting going on. Record numbers of early voting will happen. Mail-in voting, we'll see record numbers of that as well. But do you still think, do you have confidence that we won't have this, that this couldn't happen again?
Well, the question is, how many places is it going to happen? How many Brooks Brothers riots will there be? How many Floridas will there be? You know, how many states will we have narrow margins in contested elections? That's the reality, though, about Florida, is that the elections are inexplicably and perpetually determined in the margins. It's like a Miami Hurricanes FSU football game. It doesn't matter how good or bad one side or the other is, they're always decided by like a field goal.
One of the things about this film too is, you know, again, all the high profile people who were part of the story, and there were some powerful women in this story. Janet Reno, you know, Barbara Lagoa, you know, people who were tied in so many ways, whether it was the Elian Gonzalez or later the recount. But I'm wondering, did any of them want to speak to you? Because a lot of the people you talk to that we hear from are men. And I'm like, where are the women? Did they not want to talk?
Well, we interviewed, as you recall, Anne Louise Bardak, author of Cuba Confidential. And we were looking for very specific perspectives on this. You know, we had a very kind of narrow purview of the story that we wanted to tell. I reached out to some people on the Gore campaign. I won't mention who, men and women alike, none of whom wanted to travel down this PTSD-ridden memory lane. So there were certainly people who turned us down. I don't think it's appropriate for me to say exactly whom. You know, they didn't want to be a part of it for a reason. But also, we ran into the pandemic. And so when we were putting the piece together, we had an entire remote post-production on this project, which is a very new and complicated process. But when we started to encounter plays, we were like, oh, you know who we'd love to interview? You know who we'd love to talk to? We just couldn't make it happen under these conditions.
You look at all the films you've made. So, I mean, most of your work is about Miami. You know, you looked at The U Part Two, Screwball, you know, also Cocaine Cowboys. I'm wondering with this one, you know, what did it teach you about the political ecosystem that you didn't already know?
First, most important message and takeaway of 537 votes to me is that local elections matter. And people need to pay more attention and participate more in those local elections. These local officials that we elect appoint other local officials who have outsized influence in things like elections. And we see that in the documentary. These sort of yokel officials, electeds, political grifters suddenly can impact the fate of the free world. And so I think that really matters. But I think we're also seeing a group of people in this community who were born here, who now have roots here. Remember, everybody in Miami used to be from someplace else. You were from Cuba, Colombia, the Dominican, Philadelphia, Chicago. You know, everybody was from someplace else. But now we're seeing this sort of 305 till I die, this generation who have roots here and who maybe feel like they have more of a stake in the politics and in the leadership and the outcome. We're seeing that in third and fourth generation Cuban Americans who suffered in silence at their dinner table in their multi-generational household. And instead of being radicalized, said, I can't wait to be able to get out and have a voice of my own. They, you know, dissent may have been stifled at home, but now they can go out and you see Cubanos con Biden. You see, you know, you see Venezuelans for Biden, you know, and so I think it's very encouraging. I think you see people in the Haitian American community and people in, you know, and in the Cuban American community and in the other Hispanic communities who are growing, you know, you're seeing, I think, some enlightened people who are looking to be the leadership of the future here.
Let me finish with this. You know, you have a whole generation of voters who either were very young or were not there when the 2000 election happened, when all this happened. I'm wondering, how could this film help shape their understanding of everything that they see and hear happening now?
Vote. Please, God, vote. And that was really the inspiration for this, was to create a kind of mobilizing tool, a bipartisan one at that, just encouraging people to participate in their democracy. Last year, when we were talking about what we might do for the 2020 election, my producing partner, Alfred Spellman, articulates it very well, that Americans now more than ever have an affirmative obligation to get involved in their politics and in this particular 2020 election. So we wanted to do something for it. And so we were talking to our assistant at the time, who was born in 1990. So she was 10 years old during the Florida recount in 2000. And we said, what do you remember, if anything, about the Florida recount? And she shrugged sheepishly and said, hanging chads? Was that a thing? And we're like, yeah. But that was all she remembered. That was it. That was the beginning and end of it. So we wondered how many Americans who would be theoretically eligible to vote, so at least 18 years old in 2020, either were too young to remember this or weren't even born yet when the 2000 presidential election came out. 54 million Americans don't know, were born between 1990 and 2002, and don't know that the fate of the free world hung on 537 votes in Miami. Okay? And so if 537 people in Miami can impact an entire national election, certainly 54 million Americans born between 1990 and 2002 can. And so I hope they see this documentary, and I hope, as Mitchell Berger says, you have to take the time to vote.
That was filmmaker Billy Corbin behind the new documentary, 537 Votes. The film airs tomorrow night on HBO at 9 p.m., and it can be streamed on HBO Max and we'll have a link with more information on our website later today at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, three friends walk from the Panhandle to Miami. It's documented in the book In the Land of Good Living, our October Sundial Book Club pick. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, imagine traveling from the state of Florida from the Panhandle to Miami. But imagine doing it on foot. That's exactly what Kent Russell and his friends did back in the summer of 2016. From hurricane parties to meeting with spiritual mediums, and let's not forget the presidential election, all while lugging around a shopping cart of camera equipment to document the trip. Their trip was 50 years after the journey of the former Florida governor and U.S. Senator Joaquin Lawton Chiles, who walked the entirety of the state during his Senate campaign. Well, last week we spoke with Russell about his book detailing the journey. The book is titled In the Land of Good Living, and it's this month's selection for the Sundial Book Club. Now, you can read more about the book club and join by going to Facebook and searching Sundial Book Club. You're originally from Miami, but you live in New York now. And I'm wondering, what led you to want to come back to the Sunshine State? And not just that, but to take this insane journey walking from the Panhandle back to your hometown. Why'd you want to do that?
I mean, I always want to come back, to be honest. There's truly, I feel very much attached to Miami. I don't have the accents, as people can probably already tell, which to my great shame. But I feel as though I'm constantly being reeled back into it. But as to what made me want to come back and do the journey, as I mentioned in the book, it was around like 2014, early 2015. I was living with a friend of mine. He's in the book. He's Noah, and we were just sitting around, kind of spending like a normal like Tuesday night. He was out of work. I was kind of underemployed as a freelance writer. And we were watching the Little League World Series, as it happened, you know, drinking several silver bullets, as it were. And we saw a commercial for the Cheryl Strayed adaptation of Wild, like a trailer for it. And Noah was like, that's it. That's what we do. This is how I find a way to spend my time. He's a veteran, and, you know, he was getting in his PTSD a little bit, and he needed to get out, and I needed to, you know, find a new project, and he said, this is what we do.
This trip, I mean, you're basically walking in the footsteps of former Senator Joaquin Lawton Chiles. Now, for those who are not familiar with the story, who was Lawton, and how has he become something of an icon in Florida politics?
He was a former governor, our former senator. He was a huge figure in Floridian political life. But before he became who he would become, he, to get kind of the kind of name recognition that he didn't have, he figured that he would do a kind of stunt that wound up being, this thing that launched his political career, where he would walk the entirety of the state, kind of bouncing back and forth, meeting people, walking through every county, shaking hands, listening to people's political concerns, stuff like that. And yeah, so I always had this idea in the back of my mind that, you know, this guy is one of the foremost. Florida doesn't have too many heroes, as it were, and he's like one of these foremost heroes.
You took this journey with two friends, Glenn and Noah, briefly. You told us a little bit about Noah. Tell us a little bit about these two guys. And what it was like taking a journey with them? I wonder, like, how the journey either built up that friendship or maybe strained it.
Yeah, I remember telling my family about what I was planning to undertake, and they realized it before I did. They said, like, Jesus Christ, you've never spent that much time, like, one-on-one with any person in your life. These poor men. And yeah, that was totally true. That was, I'm unmarried. I've never spent, the totality of the trip was roughly 4 months. So, you know, it was like 4 months, day in, day out. And yeah, Glenn is a friend of mine that I knew from graduate school. We both went to NYU for a particular program called Cultural Reporting and Criticism. That's what I actually left Florida to go do. Was it worth it? No, but, that's what brought me up here. And yeah, we knew each other then, and he wisely pivoted away from writing to become a documentary film producer. And so throughout the trip that we took, he was filming it, and, you know, we were helping. I would, like, host a scene. Noah would hold the boom and what have you. And he we're still friends somehow. I don't know how that worked out. But yeah, we haven't. I didn't murder him on the road. He didn't poison me. Nothing like that. Having that kind of shared experience, and I in no way equate it to being like a veteran or something like that. Noah being a veteran, but that same kind of shared experience can only draw people closer, you know. And we will share that for the rest of our lives. So though there were many moments in which, for instance, we came to blows, you know, that it only brought us closer, and you know, we're proud to share it to this day.
I want to touch on a couple of the more memorable stops along the journey. You were walking in Florida in the midst of hurricane season, so there's a pretty good chance a storm might come through. You were forced to take shelter in Perry, Florida, in the northwestern part of the state as Hurricane Matthew was threatening, and you got to experience a hurricane party. Tell me about that.
Any Floridian is familiar with the hurricane party, and you know, being from Florida and having lived through Hurricane Andrew, like, I have these vivid memories of, I mean, not even just Andrew, but, you know, Hurricane Floyd, for some reason, I remember very vividly, even though it didn't really create any kind of havoc. But yeah, you know, your parents fill up the bathtub, they fill up the washing machine, you get your food, your you know, non-perishable foods, and you board up the windows. And then as soon as that's done, there's like this tremendous spirit of, like, not just conviviality, but like giving the bird to Mother Nature, saying like, we didn't evacuate. We're here. We're going to be here. Like, pointing at your chin as though you want somebody to punch you.
Moving through the story, at one point you're in the central part of the state. You come upon the city of Casadega, the largest spiritual community in the United States. It's a town unlike any, I know it, I've been through there, but how would you describe that to people who've never seen it?
Well, Casadega is, I may get this factually incorrect, but the largest continuously running spiritualist camp, at least in the southern United States. And spiritualism, for people who don't know, was kind of born after the Civil War, where the idea of, like, mediums and, like, contacting dead relatives, you know, a lot of people had lost relatives in the Civil War, obviously, and so there was a large market for people who wanted to get in touch with those that they had lost. And, you know, for the people who believe in spiritualism, I mean to take nothing away from them, but there were a lot of grifters who took up that challenge to make contact. And so Casadega is a place where, you know, it's, if you are, you have to be a spiritualist to live there. It's this very kind of small and demarcated place where only spiritualists live there. Only spiritualists can own homes. If you come there, you come there like on their terms. They have like a pretty regular clientele, mostly drawn from Orlando. And yeah, it's people who come, they meet with mediums, they contact their, lost loved ones and things like that. And yeah, it's it straddles a kind of fine line between grift and spirituality, and it's maybe the most Floridian place that exists.
You know what I thought was so funny, really interesting about the story is that there were just, it seemed like a lot of moments where either somebody was trying to run you off the road or somebody was chasing you with a gun. And I wonder, like, was there ever a point where you thought, oh my God, my life's really in danger? Were you ever, like, really scared?
This is a great instance of, or like, you know, just an example of what some would call white privilege, in which I was like, nah, I'll be fine. Like, no, I'll get shot to death. Nah, that couldn't happen. Come on. Like, I'm walking through like your backyard. Get out of here. You can't shoot me. Like, yeah, only in retrospect do I really understand how close we came to death all the time. And like how, again, truly privileged we were to not only take the walk, but to not suffer like lifelong consequences for it.
I'm speaking with Kent Russell, author of the October Sundial Book Club selection, In the Land of Good Living. You could read more about the book club and join by going to Facebook and searching Sundial Book Club. So one of the fascinating characters that you met in your travels was when you were in Tampa, and it was the owner of a famous strip club, and his name is Joe Redner. Here's an excerpt from the audiobook when you initially describe him.
The elderly, ponytailed impresario discussed his public access television shows. his ongoing crusade for First Amendment rights, his passion for social justice. Redner wore a t-shirt with Ray-Ban sunglasses hooked in the collar. He spoke with a scratchy, adopted drawl and not infrequently referred to himself as a man who is willing to stand up for the rights of those who are not even willing to stand up for their own rights. 9 times and counting, he's campaigned for the mayoralty on a platform of sustainable development, high-speed rail, and healthier school lunches. He lamented that history will remember him only as the lap dance king.
I wonder, do you see Redner like as the example of the American dream, but only available in Florida?
So much of what I tried to write about in that book is about how exactly what you said. Florida represents the American dream for so many, but it's like a concentrated American dream. It's like the principles kind of, you know, distilled, as it were. And yeah, Redner is, I mean, God bless him. And he's such a, like a, he's still running for mayor, I think, in Tampa. He's still, you know, he has these visions for a better Tampa. He's like a true kind of, a particular kind of civic patriot. And yeah, I do think that he represents a certain kind of like civil libertarianism that's, you know, not just popular in the United States, but is very popular in Florida, you know, in which you live in like an unincorporated community. You're just like this, you know, a fierce individualist and stuff like that. And yeah, I think Redner, and not only Redner, but also all of his employees who he would probably get pissed if I called them employees because they're, you know, contractors and they only come into work when they want to. Like he has created this like beautiful laissez-faire paradise for whoever wants to, you know, if you meet the criteria, you come when you want, you leave when you want, you know, same thing. But yeah, I do think that he kind of represents that kind of like libertarian consciousness that I wanted to talk about.
You know, in the backdrop of this entire trip, it was funny, is the fact that it was 2016. It was the presidential election, you know, and it's really interesting. You painted this dark picture of sitting in a bar in Central Florida as the results are coming in and a DJ's playing music in the background. You know, when you reflect back on that experience and the trip as a whole, how does it color your perspective of this election?
All the questions and all the concerns that kind of coalesced around 2016 are still being asked right now, like maybe at a higher pitch and like a more, you know, more urgency is there. But yeah, like the thing that struck me in 2016 that I hadn't really thought about, and that's another example of something that maybe I wasn't thinking about on the road, but as I wrote the book, I was like, oh man, this was like happening, you know, the entire time we were out there, and I wanted to incorporate it into the narrative. But yeah, the idea that Donald Trump represents something kind of quintessentially Floridian, where you can come down here, you know, or the advertisements of Florida are such that you can make this place your paradise. You can, you know, choose. You can extricate yourself from your Rust Belt community, all your like familial commitments, whatever. You can come down here where, you know, you can create whatever you want. You can, you know, live in whatever kind of community you want. You can create the truth that you want to live in and things like that. And I felt like he, as a political candidate, kind of represented that kind of postmodern Floridian ethos in a very interesting way. And not only, you know, did he live in Florida at Mar-a-Lago, but, you know, he kind of embodied those ideas. And yeah, I think that that's still the case. And I think that, you know, we live in, you know, the post-truth era, right? I mean, beyond people worrying about like QAnon and things like that, like everybody's kind of creating their own the American truth that they want to believe in. And, you know, nowhere has that been advertised to people more than Florida. And so, yeah, it's I totally think it's nothing much has changed. Maybe people have just gotten more entrenched in which side of that divide they might fall on.
You know, there's a quote that stood out in the book for me from your trip into Miami. You said, quote, "If Florida is hothouse America, a microcosm of synecdoche of the larger nation, then Miami is that once more again. Miami is the concentrate of the concentrate." Okay, I get what you're saying there, and I'm wondering too, because I've lived here long enough, but, you know, I can say Miami's fundamentally different from anywhere else in the country. It really is. Can it be a microcosm of America while also being a world all its own?
Absolutely. And I think that hopefully that comes across in the book, where I say that, like, Miami is basically the future. And I think that's what you mean by saying, like, it's so different than the rest of America. Like, Miami, I truly believe that, like, I love Miami. I'm so proud to be of Miami. And I do think that, like, I understand America better than somebody who grew up in, like, Cedar Rapids or something, because I know, like, you know, where this leads to. And, you know, Miami is, like, the great immigrant success story, right? Like, no other immigrant group has been more successful than Cuban Americans. They have remade Miami in their own image. Miami would have just been like a sleepy, it would have been like an Arkansas, or not Arkansas, but like a Mississippi beach town, were it not for like all this great influx of, you know, just, you know, brilliant immigrant, just energy and all the rest of it. And so, yeah, like I try to bring this up with people in New York very often, where it's actually, now that the Heat sadly have lost the NBA Finals, but the Heat always kind of engender this conversation. I'm in a bar or something back in the normal times when you could go to bars, and they'd be like, Miami, you know, it's like guys with like pointy black shoes and their shirts unbuttoned, and it's a joke of a city, blah, blah, blah. And I want to be like, do you, like, I don't think you understand, like, what you are saying. Like, you know, like, people don't, they want to kind of denigrate Miami without understanding that it's crucial importance to the country in the way that it is, like, more so than Houston or L.A. or these other kind of majority-minority cities. Like, Miami experienced it first.
Let me finish with this. When the trip was over, and you look back on everything that you had seen, everything you had done, and again, that camaraderie that you had with Glenn and Noah, also the fact that I don't know how many times you lost your toenails, but, you know, I mean, what, when it was over, what, tell me about that feeling you had.
Yeah, there's something about a journey. It is terrible when you begin it. That momentum pushes you along and it kind of sustains you, but eventually, you know, you are taken up by it, and it feels great. Like, all you want to do is continue along it, and you have a goal. You know where you're going. Like, you can chart your progress. And it's, again, like I've said, like, it's a tremendous privilege to feel that, to feel as though you're doing something and you're succeeding at it, and you know where you're going. And then by the time you're done, there is that sense that, like, now what? Without doing any kind of spoilers to my own work, that same kind of impulsion to continue and to, you know, maybe circle back around and do it again and do it better. Or, you know, there, Florida itself has this kind of pull on to people, in which, like, you come and you hope to find your treasure or your golden years, or, you know, your the happy end of your life or the happy beginning of a new kind of life or something like that. And that, coupled with the end of our journey, really, really pulled us in some interesting directions. I love my home. I know that I'm of my home. And I want to be part of this. And I truly think it's a grand movement in the last, like, you know, 5 to 10 years of people, not just in Miami, but, you know, in, or, you know, Kristen Arnett and Central Florida and everybody else has begun to define Florida as Floridians. And yeah, I'm honored to be part of that. And you know, you can agree with me, you can disagree with me, but the idea that, you know, we're all kind of taking up our artist tools and explaining and expressing Florida to the larger United States, I think is, can only lead to good things. And like I said, I think this state's the best, and you know, everybody, the art we create out of it, America should pay attention to, because, like I said, we're, in the book, I say we're the thermometer jutting from the mouth of America, and I truly believe that. Take our temperature, and you'll find out, you know, where the fever is going. So,
that is an interesting way to look at Florida, the thermometer. How about that? That was Kent Russell, author of the October Sundial Book Club selection, In the Land of Good Living. You could read more about the book club, join by going to Facebook and searching Sundial Book Club. And let us know what you think of the book as you're reading it. We always want to hear your thoughts. Well, that's Sundial for this Tuesday, October 20th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our intern is Saria Reimer. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepery. Our news director is Taryn Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zabka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. And of course, the theme music for the show is from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo. GoBalo.com. By the way, don't forget, this is a podcast, so you can always find it on iTunes, or if you missed the show, you can listen to it again at 8 o'clock tonight. Now, we don't have a show tomorrow because of the Miami-Dade School Board, but coming up on Thursday, high school juniors and seniors are preparing their college plans, and a big part of those plans requires taking the standardized test. The pandemic has impacted thousands of students who still haven't been able to take the SAT or ACT. And you know what? Florida public colleges and universities still require those tests. You can see the pickle. Plus, the Elevate Prize Foundation gave out $300,000 in funding to innovators and activists creating change in their communities in fundamental ways. Earlier this week, the winners were announced. Chad Bernstein from the South Florida-based Guitars Over Guns is one of the winners, and we'll talk to him. All of that coming up Thursday. Again, stay safe. Be good to each other. I'm Luis Hernandez. Talk to you again on Thursday.